Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P. here, as always. My guest today is the author, James Craik. I know him as a YouTuber mostly, and one of those people on Twitter, one of those people that says incendiary things, likes to lob bombs. And
I do not.
And it's good. It's good. It keeps people paying attention.
I am very polite on Twitter. I haven't gotten banned once.
I've never been banned either. I think in the last 6 months, the first time I ever even got a strike, and it was really weird what it was like complete euphemism that was misread, but whatever. At least I get to say I get a ban now. I'm in the cool kids club. Anyways.
Dude, Twitter is way too important to risk getting strikes on, man.
Sometimes it certainly feels that way. I know Facebook's useless in the marketing game. Like, unless you're going to 50 and 60 year olds, and I'm going to be honest, your cost to reach them is too high to make it worthwhile. But why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, where you started and kind of how you got into this whole indie creator scene?
So I'm James Craik. I'm an independently published author that recently started a YouTube channel, and it physically pains me that I'm known as a YouTuber, not as an author. The YouTube channel is to sell my books. And also to rant, I guess. Rant videos do really well, but what I technically am, despite my wishes otherwise, is an engineer. And I have always wanted to be an author. That's been a dream forever. And I morphed that into becoming a cyberpunk author, as well as I also put awesome epic fantasy stuff on Railroad for free. Because guess what? Sword and sandal sorcery stuff is a lot of fun. So the issue, though, is Tradpub is broken. Like, fundamentally broken. And even though I say that Tradpub is broken, that does not mean IndiePub works either. So the kind of the point of the conversation I see here is that forcing authors like me to wear every single hat in the business at once is a struggle. I'm not wildly successful with my book publishing, despite my efforts otherwise. I'm hoping that the grind continues up, because I am getting increasing numbers. Numbers do go up. I do get the dopamine hit. But I would rather be a full-time creative, and it's just not how it works right now. I have to be here marketing. I have to be networking. I have to run a YouTube channel. I have to do book reviews. I run a book club. I grab onto YouTubers' books and review them, even if I think the YouTuber in question is a very bad writer. So it's an interesting time for entertainers trying to squeeze money out of a dying economy.
Well, what I tell people specifically is, at least you're in one of the cheap ones. Books are of a low cost to entry.
Cost to entry, yes. And if you, ebooks are also cheap for the consumer to buy. You can get a lot of hours of content and entertainment for $3-4. I'm not the kind of guy that's going to sell a novella for $9. I don't do that. So as long as you can swing the cost of a cover editor, or I guess some people will do AI art nowadays, and then you have to solve the editing problem, and you have the time to do it, and you have the time to actually get good at the craft, which nobody should ever discount the amount of time it takes to actually get good before anyone is willing to give you their time. So yeah, so I started publishing maybe 2 years ago with my first book on Amazon. I also started my Royal Road series at the same time. And obviously I love the craft, what can I say? I just need to get my books in more people's hands.
So there's a couple things I wanted to key in there, because this is also relating back to some of the conversations we had. Like, one of the reasons I chose the Iron Age, and I know you have, a different opinion on what the Iron Age means.
Yeah, I don't brand myself as Iron Age, for the record.
Yeah, and that's fine.
And every time someone's defining it, they've ruled me out for one reason or another.
You're a hipster. You just don't want to be a part of the cool kids club. You know, that's all it is. I joke.
We can talk about definitions if you want.
Well, but for me, I just saw it as, and I'll take this, like, I consider myself an old school leftist. So it's about just people being able to get rid of the crappy ossified institutions that are ruining everything. Like, I think if you're a leftist or a right winger, there's nothing. TradPub offers you nothing, really. They can't even sell books themselves anymore. So going and finding a way to do it yourself is good.
What are you talking about? They sell so many copies of Dune, man. They're moving so many copies of The Lords of the Ring.
You've been selling for how many years now?
Literally, go put their interviews. They go, publishing's better than ever. We're selling millions of copies of Game of Thrones. That's how they measure themselves. There's self-help books, politician books, pornography for women, and then like these all-time classics they keep propping up because people don't know how to find other books. It's not new releases. They have nothing for new releases, and they don't care.
But the problem is like when you opt out of doing that system, you have a lot more freedom. But the problem that you run into is that the new system is not developed. Like, you don't have all of the layers of support staff. Like, the part of the thing that was nice about going to them was like, was going and having a marketing team. You know, like, their only job is to go and sell you to people and introduce you to people. And, you know, other than people like me and like, and if you know Tyler, you know, he's more in the comics manga area, stepping in to try and, like, at least in our little way, help people find the ways that they can go out and actually connect and meet people. And the one thing I do think we all at least have is that being a creative one way or another, like, the rules don't change a whole ton. It's just where you find the people. Like, as a YouTuber, bottom line is you're building an audience, and you're trying to connect with people. Same thing with your writing. So at least the rules don't change too much from one field to the next. Like, I actually come from music. That was my background. And so after years of performing in bands doing nothing, I decided I had to go and learn marketing because I was tired of playing to empty rooms and needed to get people out to the damn shows. And as a lifelong, you know, reader and science fiction horror fan, you know, I decided to kind of start paying it forward, whatnot, and help in the small ways that I can. And by no means am I like the end all be all. I've got like some LA publicist friends that I'm like, I don't even understand the craft that they do at their level. But there's like psychological things that I can help small creators work. Now, that said, what are the big things, I guess, the biggest hurdles that you've found jumping into the self-publishing scene?
So, to be fully honest, I think the biggest hurdle or perhaps the biggest danger is learning when you are getting toxic positivity. People that are being supportive of you because they like you and are basically blowing air up your skirt and saying, yeah, your book's great, when it's actually not that good. My first book has a lot that's good about it. And you know what? Well, you can say that there are things good about a book that instantly puts it in like top 25%, right? But my book had problems, and nobody was pushing back on me when I went to go publish that, because I was potentially talking to the wrong people. I'm still mostly happy with my first book, but if I had stuck out for like one more iteration, I would have launched with a much stronger material. You run into the question, of course, of not knowing how much art is worth. What's your experience with commissioning art? Have you done that?
As far as like having people make art for me, I mean, I've done a little of it myself in like the music, like, hey, I need a piece of music, you know, for this particular thing. And, you know, it's worth what it's worth to who it's worth at that particular time. Like, there is no way to value anything. Which is one of the things I do cover in the marketing side of things, is that understanding that value is completely subjective. You know, your job as a creative is to tell people what it's worth. I've had gone over and over again, like, people are charging like either too small, like, it's like, why are you just giving this away? Like, people are going to assume it's a shit book because you're only charging $2 for it. Like, nothing that's $2 can be worth my time, so I'm never going to buy that book. Whereas you'll have people that are charging $25 for something that's like 100 pages long, and you're like, I'm sorry, there's no 100 page book worth $25, certainly if I'm not paying for a hard copy. And so, yeah, reaching a value is super difficult.
Right. There's a lot of like insider knowledge when it comes to pricing. Because you have to figure out what other people are doing, if you're like overpricing or underpricing compared to them, as well as how the platforms will interact with the price of your book. And even then, like, you'd probably be shocked how much the actual print cost of my books are. Like, I sold my latest book, Your Gamma Coin, for $17, I think. but because of the paper stock, the cover quality, the printing, the shipping, all that, and then the cuts to the middlemen, I'm getting like $2 in royalties.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right.
When you know that's how it works, you go, yeah, that sounds right. For the length of the book you wrote, for the quality of the book, sure. But I've had so many people like on the street, I talked to them and be like, oh, you sold 100 books when that was my milestone. Wow, man, you made $1,700? I was like, no.
Well, what's really funny is like, so I one of my friends and a guy, my clients, you know, his first book in an effort to make sure that it hit bestseller status on Amazon so that it could be pushed through the algorithm. You know, he sold, I think, his first like 1,000 copies for like a dollar just so that you could get him out there, get it in the algorithms, getting pushing. And by the way, it still gets pushed today because he did that thing, but he makes practically nothing off of a book because, you know.
Yeah, so GamerCoin is, all right, let me grab, here's my first book, Fashion Black Zone Book 1, Faceless. I just released the sequel. I have the third book drafted out. And right now, all of my books, I believe, the ebook is at $3 because that is the lowest price that Amazon won't suppress it. Because Amazon doesn't want to give people free books. Amazon wants to make money. They will actually suppress free ebooks in favor of ebooks they can make money off of. Which is why currently the three books, but as soon as that third book comes out, I'm going to drop Faceless down to zero royalties and just not care. Because the point is to get them into a series that has two other books, and then I'm going to get fourth book, fifth book, sixth book, so on.
It's your loss leader.
Yes. The first book of a series, you basically need to treat as a loss leader, especially because it's going to be the worst book in the series, almost certainly. Because, like I said, that was my debut novel. I'm significantly better 2 years later.
One of the things I found interesting in talking to others, so like I was unaware of like how little people get for Audible books. Like you go and you could take the time and money it takes to release an audiobook, which frankly is the future of how people are going to listen to books. It's just going to go that way because it's too easy. I believe this. But the bottom line is like you make nothing off of it.
It depends on the type of book being written. Like right now, I'm listening to Legionnaire, the first book in the Galaxy's Edge series. I'm really liking it, for the record. And that kind of action schlock, yes, that is correct to consume as an audiobook. That is the best way to consume it. Or even better, like make it into an audio drama. But books like Frankenstein, for example, that I just did my book club on, you would never want Frankenstein as an audiobook. It's better in written form.
I think I've listened to Frankenstein as an audiobook. Bear in mind, like, I'm going to read at least 100 books this year, and...
Nice. I'm coming up on 60, I think.
They're going to be almost exclusively audiobooks, just because I don't have the time to sit and read physically. I have too much shit to do. I spend a lot of time driving, so...
Yeah, but if you're multitasking, you're not really consuming the book. That's the problem. If you're distracted, it's not getting your attention. So that's why lighter reads are worth.
I think there's stuff that, like, if it's good, I go back to it. And, you know, obviously I do have a large physical book collection that I do like to read. It's just, unfortunately, to cover all of the bases that I want to cover. And I'm sure you, like, especially being in the indie sphere, is there a lot of stuff that I'm necessarily going to want to go back and read again? Probably not. You know, I'm going to find the stuff that I love and that I fall in love with. I'm going to be honest, as far as writing goes, like, for me, Clive Barker's the peak. And I haven't read many people that, like, write prose like Barker does. So it's
prose is a weird discussion. A lot of people have done a lot of work in defining what good prose is, and then good prose never sells.
Well, you know, he's known for the Hellraiser movie. Like he wrote a ton of great short stories. His claim to fame was Stephen King saying, "I've seen the future of horror. And it's Clive Barker," and ultimately, he's known as the guy who directed and wrote Hellraiser. But whether or not good prose is, I enjoy what he does, and it feels just like a better read to me than, like, frankly, Stephen King himself. Like,
I've read very little King. Honestly, by the time I started getting it, I got to the point where I was like, maybe I should read King. He's super influential. I had already been exposed to him via Twitter. And I was like, I really don't like this man.
Oh, that would be tough. I read Stephen King's The Dark Half when I was in like fourth grade, so. Probably a little early to be reading Stephen King at any rate, but so tell me a little bit about your we'll say your cyberpunk series, because that's the kind of stuff I'm into. What's the idea behind the series of books?
So I think that cyberpunk genre has been trapped by itself. Basically, it's stuck in the 1980s in a lot of ways. For example, Cyberpunk 2077 that came out, big splash, glitchy mess. That is an IP from the 80s. And it has a lot of themes and concerns that were pertinent at the time that no longer make sense. Like the genre is pre-internet, even though it's about the internet in a lot of ways. So that, to me, makes it ring really false nowadays when we know certain things. Like we're all watching Neuralink. And we're all kind of hesitantly going, like, okay, yeah, if they can fix this, it's probably going to be the normal thing to have, you know, brain-machine interfaces. But hey, look, all the monkeys died, right? Like, nobody's really jumping to rip out all their flesh in favor of Chrome, which was one of the major concerns of, oh my God, technology is consuming my soul.
See, it's funny, the way that you ask that, you say that, is actually what's interesting. The bottom line is that all those guys that wrote that stuff, they didn't write it as cautionary tales. They wrote it as like this beautiful future that they couldn't wait to be a part of. You get into a lot of the trans movement stems from those people and their desire to shed the skin and become one with the singularity. Like those guys, a lot of the guys in the Cyberpunk movie are strange.
I think you're looking at the second movie. Cyberpunk 2077, or its predecessor, 2020, was not pro-transhumanism, as far as I can tell. Like, as soon as you introduce cyberpsychosis as a key mechanic, you are not in support of ripping apart your body.
I think there's certain people that maybe were that.
There are secondary movers that latched onto it because it's a really cool aesthetic.
Well, Kurzweil is the guy I'm thinking of in particular that really is a complete nut job about all of this. But yeah, I was always weird when I saw Cyberpunk 2077 come out, because for me, I knew Cyberpunk as a board game that I used to play with my buddy's dad, like when I was a kid, not a board game, but like tabletop RPG. And like, I just remember how much I loved the classes in that game compared to like standard D&D. I'm like, you mean like I can be a hitman and like just go out and kill people and like get cybernetics? This is the best version of RPG. Well, how do we do more of this?
So yeah, there's also super heavy capitalist themes in the old incarnations of cyberpunk, because it really was a time where globalism and the Zaibatsu corporate culture were new and not really understood. And that just hasn't played out. We're marching into a cyberpunk dystopia of a government nanny state where the government has merged with corporations rather than corporations have shed off the constraints of government. The entire dynamic of reality is not what people think of in the cyberpunk genre. But there's still a lot of these common concerns, which is why I wanted to try and rebuild cyberpunk from the ground up. I created a setting, a Judge Dredd style mega city where the main character is like the one cop still trying to do the right thing. And I'm structuring it around stories and crimes and such that exist in the cracks in the system. Like, for example, the first one is, okay, so we're getting this surveillance state, such as what has already happened in London with, like, the ULEB zones and all that lovely stuff. Everything's being monitored, and there is, like, the good aspect of that, such as if you were to have a heart attack and keel over, you would instantaneously, automatically have an ambulance coming to save you. That's a good thing, but you're paying with your privacy and all that, and so I asked the question of, okay, so how does that system fail? How does someone die and the system doesn't realize it? It doesn't even know that they're a person that has died and rotted away in this apartment. So I wanted to look at the crack and have that fun of examining the way the system breaks and how people interact with it and how people will intentionally subvert the technology. That's another theme I like to get into, is that no matter what, just because there's technology creating a system, there is a human doing it. When there is something wrong going on, there's still a human doing it behind the scenes. So I think cyberpunk is a awesome aesthetic. I think it's cool. I think the technology is fascinating. I think it can solve problems, but I think humans are going to find new problems to have, and I like exploring them. And I'm also tired of fiction that has like super doomer nihilist endings where everyone dies and it's horrible. Looking at you, cyberpunk edge runners.
So from a philosophical like position, that absolutely is right up my alley and like totally all about it. Now, do you have a like hero protagonist, quote unquote, to reference, that's, you know, a very strong central character?
Hero protagonist, the guy from Snow Crash.
Which I always thought was the probably the best joke of that book, was like, literally, like, just tell you exactly what we got here.
It's one of the only jokes I had. So yeah, like I said, the main character is Detective Blackstone. So in a sense, it's not cyberpunk. It's technically tech-noir, because the main character is a police officer. He's not a punk.
And that was my next question. It sounds very noir.
Yeah, it's technically tech-noir, but no one knows what the hell tech-noir is. Cyberpunk is branding, it's marketing. People know what they're getting into. Like, they open the book and it's like corporate VTubers and holograms and virtual reality matrix level. You know, people are flying around on hoverboards. It's got all the cool crap of cyberpunk, even though it's technically a noir detective story. Sue me. But yeah, the idea is that he's like the one guy that still cares. It's a highly urbanized, in a lot of ways, broken society where like the number one thing that police do, because most of the day-to-day police work has been outsourced to private security firms that work for the corporations. The police are known for showing up and killing drug dealers and like almost nothing else because they're not obligated to do anything else.
And it's, hey, stop the paperwork here.
But yeah, Detective Blackstone is the one that actually shows up when people have problems and genuinely tries to help, even though everyone hates him because he's a cop.
Okay. I don't know why, for some reason, like thinking about that's reminded me of Brazil a little bit. Only I hope less dystopian than Brazil is.
Yeah, surprisingly, it's not a dystopia. It was like meant to be a dystopia. It's this walled megacity where no one's allowed to leave, ruled over by a technically fascist government, where the police have authority to just kill people left and right.
Okay.
And yet it's better than current day somehow.
I don't know, sound much different than current day in a lot of places, but...
Exactly. The big difference is the government doesn't really care how you live your life. They aren't prying in to try and read your brain Big Brother style like we're currently seeing. They just don't care. As long as they stay in charge, everything's fine.
Interesting. Now, obviously, there's a lot of politics involved in there. Is that, like, did you go into writing a book, like, very politics-heavy? The book you're writing is very similar to one I tried to write and then decided it would be too damn preachy if I tried to write it. I might as well write a philosophical book as opposed to an actual fiction book.
Yeah, so the thing is that there are social-political themes, but, like, a surveillance state really isn't, like, a political issue. Like, when people say it's oh my god, you bring politics into fiction or something, they're talking about a few very specific issues, which I don't write about those, you know, third-rail issues. You know, the idea of, internal corruption or, the police force not bothering to crack down on crime because it doesn't serve their purposes and so on. Those aren't particularly controversial things. And they're things that everyone should be able to agree on.
Well, the real reason I ask that question isn't so much that I care about the politics. It's just when people tend to put politics in the front of what they're doing, you tend to get a shitty product. If like they care more about their political messaging than the writing, like most libertarian musicians I know are terrible because all they want to do is preach politics and didn't learn, oh, I've got to write a good song along the way here.
Yeah, the book has to be entertaining. It like Faceless is a murder mystery, first and foremost. This one explores the situation with the gangs and the fact that you can't leave the city. And why you can't leave the city. Spoiler alert, there's a pandemic outside the walls. That may or may not be an issue. Yeah, you groan, but it's not...
I groan because I'm like, 2 years ago when I was fixing to write my fiction novel, I'm like, yeah, it was part of it. Definitely part of it, yeah. It's all kind of in there because how could you not?
Yeah, so but the thing is, this is a story of a manhunt. It is a kid... made a mistake and he broke a beer bottle over someone else's head because the guy was kissing his girlfriend and the guy went down. Oh, murder. Oh, that's a life ruined. Oh my God. And he goes on the run and Blackstone is the one that has to try and bring him in because the victim was the son of a congressman. And I get into that, is it corruption or is it not angle? Because the congressman basically calls up the police department and says, get this guy now. That was my son. Your funding depends on this. And it's just like, well, he is a criminal. He should be brought to justice. We're getting, the priority is being set for improper reasons though.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, obviously given the name of the show and what I told you beforehand, I want to spend a couple minutes kind of deciphering what are the things, I guess, as far as like reaching an audience and getting your name out there, that have frustrated you most or that you found that you've had the most success in and perhaps maybe been surprised with?
I think if you ask any author and they don't lie to you, the actual answer is going to be how few people read. Reading is just dying. The industry is propped up by whales like you that read 100 books in a year. The average, I would predict that the median amount of books read by an adult American is zero.
I believe the average is most Americans don't read a book after 12th grade, a single book. So
when I like go to the clubs and events in the area or host a talk at my local library and all that, and I talk to people and I go like, so do you read? And like, oh, I just don't have the time. It's like, oh, really? Because you were just telling me about Netflix. You have all this time to rewatch The Office on Netflix, but you won't crack open a book. It doesn't even have to be my book. I want people reading, period. But everyone spends their time on TikTok or Netflix or hate watching Disney movies. So
I watched 7 Marvel movies. That's it. Out of the entire run, I saw 7 of them.
There were more than 7 good ones. There's not much more, though.
No, that's just all I saw. I've never cared about superheroes, so I never bought into it. I like James Gunn is the only reason I watched the Guardians movies, because he did cool stuff.
Yeah. So the disconnect, it creates this issue where no matter how good my book is, even if my book were the best thing ever put to paper, I still cannot sell it to most people.
To get to like a basic question, so why do you write? Like, what is the thing that pushes you to do that?
Internally compelled to.
Okay.
No, I do approach it as a business. I do make business decisions for my writing and which stories I prioritize writing, how I release them, the effort I put into marketing, what the whole reason I made a YouTube channel.
Yeah, no, obviously that goes out of the question.
But I am compelled to write.
Yeah. I've tried to quit music many times in my life, and unfortunately, I'm compelled to plug into the computer and make songs. Often be much easier not doing that. But, you know, what you want to do is what you want to do. I'm curious, do you feel like there's any hope with, like, translating mediums? Like, maybe books aren't the thing, but obviously, like, video games are the biggest thing in the world. And is your story going to be the one that gets translated?
These particular stories that I've written so far, no. Because I wrote stories that are correct to be prose novels, because that's what I am, at my audience size, that's what's intelligent for me to be doing.
Okay.
I have stories that I want to turn into graphic novels, for example. I have, right now I'm finishing up a manuscript that I'm going to be submitting to a contest that I think is fantastic. I think the series of everything I produced with the most potential for people to enjoy. And I want to get that into board games. I've got a living card game designed for it that should be a lot of fun. It hits a niche in the market that I just don't have the funds to really go after. I'm dreaming of a 2D hack and slash video game I want to build inspired by the series. Yeah, no, I would love to get into other mediums. But there's the obvious issue with those other mediums. Let's just start with comic books. If I want to produce a comic book based on one of my short stories, that's going to be a super nice and tight horror story at 70 pages. I need $7,000 for the internal artwork. And I need to raise $7,000 by pre-selling copies that I'll also have to be printed. So I have to sell a graphic novel at like the $35 price point. If I'm only going to be selling, say, 200 copies based on my audience size. Now, if I can amortize the art price across 2,000 sales, whoa, suddenly it starts making more sense. Or, you know, it's competitive. I'm getting bulk print rates. If I can split it over 20,000 sales because I have this enormous reach like Eric July has, whoa, suddenly I can sell that graphic novel for like $15. But that's when it starts making sense for people to buy it, because a 90-page graphic novel is maybe 2 hours of entertainment. So I'm asking them to spend $7.50 an hour, which is, that's luxury rates of entertainment. And that's at the wild success mark. $35 for 2 hours of entertainment is absurd.
Well, but I will argue, like, what are we getting entertainment-wise out there to compete? Like, if you're giving me good entertainment, I'll pay for it.
Well, on the other hand, though, I could sell you a paperback. I could sell you a paperback for $17, and this is 10 hours of entertainment. So I'd almost be competing with myself, in a sense. And then, obviously, the math just gets more absurd. Like, if I want to release a simple game, like I said, a 2D hack and slash, I'm probably going to need $500,000 in funding for the assets and the program, the coding and development, marketing and such. How would I raise $500,000?
That's an interesting question.
With a large audience.
Well, but that's the thing, the bottom line you can't get around is it doesn't matter what you're doing. Like, you do need an audience. You need to attract people. It all does come back to the marketing. That's why I do what I do. And I guess my frustration is, like, I was watching your interview and Sanderson talking about, you know, well, everyone's got to go and become a celebrity to bring readers in. You can't just bring people in. I think Sanderson forgets that the reason Sanderson is a thing is because he took over and gained pretty quick celebrity for being the guy that finished the Wheel of Time books.
Right. But that was an opportunity that went to him because he proved himself to an industry that he had creative talent.
Absolutely.
And they said, okay, so we have a machine that we can slot you into because of an untimely death, which, by the way, Robert Jordan said basically anointed him as his successor.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember. My dad was a Wheel of Time guy, so I remember when it happened.
Okay, don't hate me. I've never finished Wheel of Time. It gets so boring.
I've not read a single book, but I take it for what they are. They seem like they're too politics for me, for the same reason I never got into George R.R. It's all, I don't know, kings and shit. And I don't care about kings. I want to hear about, like, the guys in the ground level hacking and slashing.
Fair enough. Unfortunately, there is a tendency to end up writing only about the kings and the nobles because they're the ones that make the decisions. I think you'd want to go check out Black Company if that's what you're looking for, is on-the-ground peons. Although I didn't really get the appeal of Black Company, to be honest.
I'd be lying if I didn't say, like, look, the bottom line is that you go out there, people like the intrigue. That's why people watch Real Housewives of LA, because they like the stupid drama. I'm not that guy. Like that's why, like, when I saw people getting really into creating, like, new pulp, like, I'm like, oh, I like that. That's my kind of thing. Give me more Lovecraftian kind of shit.
It depends. I'm very leery as a consumer of people that are just like, oh my God, I am writing a return to form, going back to basics, like the good old days of Robert E. Howard. And it's just like, bro, I can read Robert E. Howard instead. Why would I read yours? I can read 80 years of people working with publishers writing more Conan stories that nobody likes. Why would you be any different?
Well, I mean, but that's because some writers are better than other writers.
Yeah, but if you market yourself as return to form, you're then getting compared against one of the most successful fantasy stories of all time, and that's not a favorable comparison.
I guess for me, you're marketing yourself. Like, when you're doing that, you're not marketing yourself as a return to form. What you're doing is saying, you're comparing yourself to something in place in somebody's mind. Like, hey, this is what we're like. I mean, to me, it's always like the, what are you like and how much does that matter? Like, one of the things I struggle with writers is that they all want to talk about their story and they're all kind of the same. Like, there's only so many fucking stories. Like, we all know that and we kind of ignore it because we want the new story. For me, like, I find so few writers focusing on what does matter, which is your main character. If you have a main character that I resonate and can kind of see myself into, like, why the fuck does everybody like Sherlock Holmes after all these years? Because he's just, the character himself is something that you find something that you resonate with.
Vicarious competency.
The question I always ask is, if you look at the X-Men, is there a single person on the planet who doesn't have a favorite X-Men that knows the X-Men? Like, within them, you find the thing that you gravitate towards. You know, I like Beast and Nightcrawler. Those are my guys. You know, some people like Cyclops. I think Cyclops is the worst character ever made. But he does kind of make the other characters cooler by comparison.
So I have definitely heard and seen people that fit the mold of what you're describing. But I want to defend myself. Because for me, for my series, the main character doesn't make sense until you realize that the reason he's the main character is because he is a reaction to the setting. And the setting is important because it is a reflection of today. Cranked up to 11 with some cool technology and, you know, waifus and stuff. So I do have to lead with a discussion about the setting, the tone, and such, because the character is the contrast point. He is the guy that says, no, I am still going to be a good person.
I'd never say that the story doesn't matter. Like, the bottom line, like, I want a horror story, I want a science fiction story, I want a cyberpunk story. That's very important to what you're doing. Like, it's not unimportant. It's just, I think some writers tend to, like, I'm rewriting Tolkien here, and, you know, I fixed all the problems. Like, really, you're just telling a story, bro, and it's either good or bad. You got to give me a finger hold in there. What's the hook? What's the thing that makes it different? And they're usually, if you're focusing on story, there's usually not much different between your story and somebody else's, frankly. Right on. It's certainly been an interesting episode. I have a feeling that we could be antagonistically talk for, about a lot of interesting things.
Antagonistically? This is called an entertaining conversation.
They're all entertaining. I like those kind of conversations. I'm sure my wife is listening somewhere going, did you just yell at him the whole time? And I didn't. I didn't yell. Like, I'm a crazy person that watches people on the internet. And I yell, God, you're missing this. What, you forgot all about that. So I talk to myself a lot. And she assumes that I'm going to do that with people on the internet, as opposed to, like, try and have a normal, nuanced conversation about, you know, where we can find common ground and ways that we can help, you know, other people do stuff. I had a lot of fun today, to be completely honest. So
thanks for having me on.
Where can we send people to get them to check out your books, learn more about you and all that?
So I do have a WordPress, jamescrack.com. It's my name. The link should be in the description. You can find my epic fantasy over on Rural Road, which that's a horrifically long link. Good luck with that. You can find it on my website. My Twitter handle is at Craik James. I had to reverse it because someone has a defunct Twitter handle of my name. So that's and obviously my YouTube channel at James Craik.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, James. Hopefully get some people to go out and take a look at your books, buy all of them.
That would be very nice. Leave reviews, tell friends, leave them in strange places for other people to find.
Do the manga thing, right?
Make memes.
Actually, here, I'm going to ask a really pointed question. What is the thing that you would most like someone to do after they've read a book of yours?
Well, the generic answer is leave a review on Amazon because I need to get to 50 reviews and the algorithm changes. Books with more than, or maybe they've changed it because we figured it out, but you need to hit a review threshold for you to actually get promoted. But honestly, what I want to see is people like aspiring artists that aren't the kind of people that are still getting their feet wet and getting good at the craft. Instead of making fan art about Marvel characters or whatever, I want to see them, maybe not as, obviously I prefer mine, but this is a generic thing I'd like to see, is fan art of indie works. Because that's how you build a community outside of the entrenched IPs.
I'm a big fan of, like, writers doing, like, you know, character art contests and things like that. Like, hey, I just want to see what you guys think so-and-so looks like in this book. Like, what is the image in your head? If for no other reason than as a creator myself, like, it fascinates me. What are the ideas that I put out there put into other people's heads? What is the wave that sends out? You know, so awesome. Well, folks, go out, read his books, and then draw some pictures and, you know, tell him what you think of him.
I do actually have an open invite. If someone reads my book and wants to tell me to my face how it's bad, they can come on my stream and do so.
If I think it's bad, I'll tell you it's bad. Just so we're clear. I won't probably...
Yeah, you'd have to go read it, man. Come on.
It's on the list.
I don't even charge for most of my writing.
Yeah, but I have the ones that I want to read, and you do charge for them.
Yes, because those are the better ones.
I hate to drag on. How much of, like, what you do you feel like should be lost? Is that the only reason? Is because you just don't feel like things are good enough to charge for? That you do have them, or...
So I can actually be very clear with how I view my free stuff versus the stuff I charge for. What I put on Royal Road, which is my epic fantasy story, The Undying Emperor, a story of a literal Hoot who conquered the entire world with no steps skipped. I do not cheat. He is going to rise through every rank and conquer every territory. He is actually going to conquer the world. So I don't think anyone has ever legitimately written that story before.
That sounds so long and boring.
It is web novels. Okay, it's not boring. Fuck you.
I'm saying that as a guy who just said I hate Wheel of Time and George R. R. Martin because it sounds too much like those things.
You should actually look at how I broke it up because I'm breaking it up as, like, basically each region he goes to and fights in is one contained standalone book, essentially, and they're just sequentially stacked. So, the first act. Or act one, I should say, not the first act, is the same length as Infinite Money Glitch. And it is a Civil War plotline where the main character steals the identity of a nobleman, steals his place in the army, and leads it to success. And then says, yes, I am Lucius von Salhart. Look, I just proved it by saving everyone, wink, wink. And that should be a fully satisfying story by itself. And then it gets followed up with, and this is when he goes to the king and gets his appointment to the colony over here. And then, oh, he's now ruling this colony and he has to track down the demon that's screwing it up and such. They are self-contained stories. And it's just every time, after every adventure, he gets a bit more status, a bit more power, a bit more reach, a larger army, etc.
So you're doing this like Dungeons and Dragons style where it's like, you know, level up each book.
Kind of, well, the term is progression fantasy, and basically.
Well, if for those of you into progression fantasy, it sounds like we got another winner for you.
Yeah, but the difference is that stuff that I put up for free, I don't edit. That's a first draft that you're reading. And it is, I publish week by week the chapters. So sometimes the pacing gets off. Sometimes plot lines get forgotten. Like, I've actually forgotten characters from earlier in the book. I've been doing this for, I've been writing this story for 3 years. I have to go back digging sometimes.
So it sounds like this is almost like your newsletter. Like, it's like the thing that you do that's kind of like, so you always have a steady stream of content going out.
Yeah, I have, on average, 1,400 people reading every chapter. They won't convert to science fiction, though. It drives me crazy.
Who are the people that actually made Hollywood take notice because of how powerful a block there? It's the Lord of the Rings people, because they're the people that actually do still read books and they care about that stuff. So, I mean, it's that audience is that audience. I think with science fiction, one of the things you're always going to kind of run into is that it is as cool as whales like me are that like reading shit like Snow Crash. The bottom line is, that stuff is so visually interesting. Like, there's a lot that you can have when you're visualizing. And so, like, I think people tend to go that way.
I actually think it's the other way around. Most science fiction is either complete aesthetic nonsense, if you actually get into it with an engineering mindset, or it's grunge. And a proper fantasy should be 1,000 times more visually stimulating than science fiction. Like Avatar, for example, as just like the poster child of shockingly beautiful science fiction. There's no reason that couldn't be a fantasy.
I thought it was fantasy. It's just not, to me, it misses a lot of the criteria of what science fiction's supposed to be. I'm very particular about what we call science fiction. So, but I don't need to drag you through that gamut.
It shows like Wheel of Time and The Witcher, where it's just like every scene is a dirty forest. That make you think fantasy isn't visually interesting. But anyways, just to finish the point, my science fiction gets beta readers, it gets multiple rewrites, I get it as a complete product and let it sit and I review it. I definitely put more thought into why do people want to read this story. For example, Infinite Money Glitch, why do you want to read this? Because you, like me, were probably lost a lot of money in the GameStop short squeeze fiasco, and I'm still mad about that, so I wrote an entire book about it. That's funny, by the way.
No, I learned about Austrian economics a long time ago and didn't buy into that fiasco knowing what would end up happening.
I was talking to the viewer. But yeah, so the books I put on Amazon get a lot more polished, a lot more work, and they come up to a higher standard. So, you know, that's the story. I give away what I'm just having fun with. Like, I have an entire act in my in Undying Emperor that isn't even about Lucius. I wanted to write an epistolary horror story about what some of the other characters were doing, it, you know, behind the scenes. And so I have a 20,000-word novella in there in a completely different style, but completely different characters. It's just the same world. And it's, like, written in a completely different tone. And I think it's the best thing I have in the web novel. And people are just kind of like, okay with it, because I give it away.
Okay. Well, okay, last question. Do you think they should eventually make a sequel to The Matrix? I kid.
I don't know how to respond to that.
They never should, and they never did.
Look, so The Matrix is, I have complicated feelings about The Matrix because it's obviously incredibly inspiring. It impacted Hollywood heavily. And then I read the source material, and yes, there is source material. It's horrifically dull.
You mean all of the guys that they ripped that off of directly?
No, I'm talking about Simulations of Simulacra by Jean Baudrillard, as well as Plato. And I've listened to some of the interviews Jean Baudrillard had about it, and I realized how stupid the Wachowski siblings are. They basically stumbled their way into a good movie that they don't even understand.
Well, hence they thought it needed sequels. and made a bunch of terrible, terrible things. Like, the thing with The Matrix is it was a great philosophical movie and gave you a lot of ideas to think about. And then they tried to expand the world, and that's the worst thing you can do with that kind of fiction.
They lacked the competency to expand it. You definitely can expand off of Matrix 1. It was not the way they did that, though.
So you think that someday we should make the Matrix sequel and have it be good? Is it gonna be your books that make those movies? That's what they're gonna base it off of.
I would love to see, not as a movie. Bastion Blackstone needs to be a miniseries.
Okay.
Yeah, let me get like 7 novels out, and you can all the mysteries can get interspliced, because there's actually a lot of simultaneous action. Got a whole timeline document about like Gamma Coin opens with one of the characters listening to a news report about a riot, which is the instigating action of book 3. So everything's actually really meshed together and cool, and would make a perfect miniseries, in my opinion.
Well, where was this like 6 years ago when Netflix was just throwing development deals for science fiction shows? You were still being an engineer, right?
6 years ago, I had just graduated college, more or less, and I was getting my day job career established and thought, and I drifted away from writing at the time. And it took the lockdowns for me to look at myself and go, holy crap, I'm getting old, and I have not pursued the thing that I always said mattered to me, which was becoming an author.
Right on. That's a perfect way to end everything right there for me. So thank you once again for coming on here, James. You have yourself a good one. Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironagemarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.